Mr. Ward, can I have you begin by introducing yourself, please?
My name is Tim Ward. I'm currently a resident down in the city of Reddick, Florida. I was one of the survivors of the 2014 Oso mudslide, and we're here for an interview this morning.
Well, let me begin with a very broad question then. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience on March 22nd of 2014?
On March 22nd, 2014, I remember the morning. It was quite comfortable. It was a sunny day. It was one of the first sunny days we'd had in months. We had had an extremely wet winter. My wife and I were sitting in the living room. We were getting ready to do what most husband and wives do on weekends. We had a group of five German short-haired pointers that got pampered quite readily, and on that weekend, she was getting ready to fix them a big fry pan full of scrambled eggs, and I was going to go get a shower. And we both went our separate ways, and we were just finished a cup of coffee apiece, and we were living the dream. And I had gone in to get ready to get a shower, and I heard what I thought was going to be the Navy jets that flew by up the valley every other weekend. We could hear them come up there, and they'd be doing their training runs, and heard that shaking and heard that rumbling. But something happened, and that rumbling did not go away. It continued to get louder and louder, and I realized suddenly, as the lights flickered and as the water pressure dropped off, that we must be having an earthquake. So I quickly grabbed my towel and headed towards the hallway, and I could hear my wife calling out my name as I got near the edge of the hallway to get into a door jamb, which was going to be the most secure place, I thought, in the house. And what was happening was the mudslide had started. A portion of the mountain had broken away from being saturated. It had hit the river, which was just at the base of the mountain, and it was like hitting a sheet of Teflon, and it accelerated. And it took just a matter of seconds from the time it started until it came through. And what was happening with my wife was she saw what was coming through, because there was a series of large plate glass windows that she could see upriver. And so she was trying to give me warning. And at that moment, I could feel the mud coming up my legs, and I could feel it coming up my chest. And I knew one of two things was happening. Either one, it was the worst dream I had ever had in my life, and at which I'd wake up and I'd be fine. But if it wasn't a dream, I knew that I was about to face some challenges, and I started praying. And one of the last things I remember was hearing her voice, feeling the mud coming up over my nose, and my prayers going out to the Lord Jesus Christ that I don't have time to die right now. I have too much to do for you. And that's honestly the last comment that I can remember until I woke up. And I don't know how long it was before I woke up, but I woke up about 500 yards downhill from my house, about 15 feet below the surface. And I was one of the lucky nine that had an air pocket above my head, and I could start doing a little bit of egress and a little bit of self-evaluation.
I heard that you could see a little sky above you.
I could. I could actually see the blue sky. I saw the top of some fir trees. I could see them blowing, and I realized that I wasn't in my home any longer. I wasn't really sure where, but I knew that I had to start doing some evaluation. And from my military background, I just started my toes and working my way up. And when I got throughout the assessment, I realized that I must be in some trouble, because my body was facing one way and my legs were facing another.
What branch did you serve in, sir?
I was in the U.S. Army. I was a helicopter pilot when I finished my service with the 101st Airborne.
Okay. So how did you get out?
I started calling out for my wife, and I did not get a response from her, but I did get a response from another gentleman. He was one of my neighbor's fathers, and he was also buried. He was close enough we could hear each other, but that's all I could understand. So I started trying to whistle. I started trying to call out. And eventually, one of my neighbors that I didn't even know, he was from Seapost Road, he came down and he heard me, and he asked me if I could show him somewhere where I was at. And so I found a piece of debris that I poked up through the hole. And he says, I've got good news for you and I got bad news for you. I said, what's that? And he says, the good news is I can see you. The bad news is it's about an hour away. Because what was taking place was he had to take a piece of roofing material, the pressed tin that you'd see on a metal roof, and use that as something to stand on, because you can imagine it was like quicksand. And for him to move, he had to be able to hopscotch from one piece of metal to the other. Mm. And about the time he got to where my mound was, where he was going to start digging me out, I saw a helicopter fly by. I could see it through the opening in the hole. I called out to the neighbor, and he says, I see it too. I'll wave him down. And he waved down a U.S. Navy helicopter. It was a Black Hawk helicopter.
I understand that you have kept in touch with many of the other folks who were affected. I believe I heard that there was a Facebook group you were all part of, and you would kind of talk about doing good works in the community and doing other things for the community.
What we had experienced wasn't isolated to us, but it was to all of the people that had been involved, because there were 52 people home that morning, either as residents or as people working on property out there as contractors or vendors. And of those 52 people, there were only 9 of us that were dug out. So for the other 43 people, there were thousands of people that were touched, either in pain or in remorse or in confusion, in loss. But at the same time, they were giving to us in such a way that you really couldn't describe. The comfort was warming, and it was deep. It was passionate. And we realized that, you know something? We as survivors, as family members, as fellow people that had been dug out, or as in family members who had come to the support group, like the Pozanka family, they lost 3 generations of their family out there. And we have learned over the years how to reach out and do things that to the average person would seem so simple. To provide a Thanksgiving meal to the homeless, or to provide a sanitary kit to hand out to someone who doesn't have what you would think of as the normal daily life things, like toilet paper and baby wipes and some snacks for during the day when they're trying to make it in whatever situation they are. I know in Snohomish and King County, they're experiencing something with an opioid crisis. And we realized that, you know, just like we were buried in mud and we needed help, that some of the other community members did as well. And so we started reaching out and trying to find what it was we could do.
It seems like what you've just described might even be part of the healing process.
Oh, most definitely. Because we've learned how to give from the place we stood at. Instead of being a counselor that stands there and speaks from his book learning or his training, we were actually able to turn around and say that, honestly, I do know what you're going through. I have felt that pain. I do know that loss. I know that void in my heart. And so with those things happening, it gave us the ability to reach out and hold someone and to comfort them and to let them know that they really, truly were loved.
You know, I think sometimes about disasters that hit elsewhere, you know, fires and tornadoes and hurricanes across the country. And I'm wondering, do you experience that differently when you see it on the news than you would have before what happened to you happened?
I do. As a matter of fact, I was on my phone this morning looking at the news while I was having a cup of coffee, and they were talking about the tornado that just went through a little Alabama town here about a week and a half ago, and about all the people that were killed. And there was this one family lost a lot of family members, just as some of our families had in Washington State. And the lady's video tape that was out there, she said, when I found out that the house was gone, I said, thank you, God. And when I found out that my family members were gone, I said, thank you, God. And when I found out that our utility trailer was gone, I said, thank you, God. And a lot of people may not understand that, But I think what she was trying to say was is that no matter how bad it gets and no matter how low you feel you may be at, if you're alive and you're on this earth and you've got the ability to do something that you're passionate about, then you need to thank the Lord that you're still on this earth. And I think this young lady was basically trying to say that she's been through it. She's been through the worst, maybe not the worst she'll ever go through, but she now has a place, a focal plane to focus from, to give out the compassion that she needs to spread forward.
If it's not too personal, did what happened to you shake your faith?
Actually, it didn't shake it. I think it forced me to convict myself that my faith had to go from worshiping God in a church with a building and doors and windows to taking Christ and the Lord on my shoulders and saying, we're a team, and through you I can do anything. And it really gave me the conviction that I'm not afraid to tell people what my thoughts are. Now, would I ever go and tell somebody else they're wrong? No, that's not what I'm doing. What I truly believe is wherever God puts me, whether it's the place I live, the people I meet, the situations I'm in, that is a plan, that is a dialogue, that is a chapter in my book that I'm going to go through, and I'm going to do it for the glory of the Lord that I truly believe has put me here for a purpose, and I'm still excited, and I'm waiting to find out what the final purpose will be.
When did you move to Florida?
I moved to Florida in 2016. I had come across country on a journey, which I had sat with my fire chief, Willie Harper, and I said, look, I don't know what my life has. I said, but I'm feeling like my journey here has finished, and I need to find out what's going on. And he and I sat down and talked about it. And then back in February or March of that year, I got on the road and started driving. I had no idea where I was going to go other than the fact that my brother lived down in Homestead, southwest side of Miami, and that I was going to make that as my final destination. And somewhere along the road, I was going to stop. I took my service dog, Blue, with me, who was the only surviving dog of that pack of five that I had. And we got on the road, and we just started meeting people. And I looked on the map, and I said, well, I've got a relative here, and I've got a friend there. And I just stopped, and I shared the fact that I was excited to be alive. And it got down to Miami, and my brother had mentioned to me that he said, hey, I've got a friend that's got a boat down in the Keys. Would you like to go fishing? Got down there that evening, and there was going to be a dinner at the house. We were going to have a little barbecue and a few drinks and just sit out on the porch like they do in South Florida and enjoy the comfort. And I said, Kevin, I got a question for you. I've got a friend that lives real close to here. I wonder if I can call that friend up and invite the person over. And he said, well, you'll have to ask the hostess of the party. So I did. And when I called up a young lady, her name was Clara Werner. And I said, hey, Clara, this is Tim. We'd been on Facebook for years, I think since 2009. Her and my wife and I, we all actually grew up in high school together in junior high. I said, would you like to come over for dinner? She says, well, sure, where are you at? And I give her an address, and she says, I'll be there in 10 minutes. And let's fast forward about a week. I felt an urge in my heart, and I had to call her and talk to her. And I'll fast forward past that urge in the discussion we had with Clara that night. But about a year later, I proposed to her. I proposed to her on the Space Needle in Seattle after she'd come out and met my children, after I had been out and met her family. And we got married on April 8th, 2017. And it's been a time of total joy and recovery. And as a matter of fact, she's sitting here with me smiling as we talk. And I can't be more happy with the way the Lord has changed my life. And now, don't take me wrong. I would go back to my old life in a heartbeat if that was what the Lord God had planned for me. But for some reason, he chose differently. And I'm not going to argue with the man who created the universe. And so at this point in my life, I'm happily going down the path that he's given me. with my service dog, Blue, which we haven't talked a whole lot about. He was, like I said, he was the last dog that was found. And he wasn't found until the third day. He was found by a friend of mine in Arlington, who is one of the range masters at the local range, gun range in town. And he found Blue buried under a pile of cedar trees. Huh. And poor little Blue had been trying to get out of there for 3 days. He had degloved his own foot, trying to pull his foot out. And then he had dislocated his right hip. But he was still alive. They got him out to a vet in one of the veterinarian hospitals up in Mount Vernon. Took very good care of him. He's an extremely agile and strong 12-year-old tripod German Shorthair Pointer now. And 90% of the time, everywhere I go, he's right there with me.
How does he like Florida?
He thinks he's in heaven. A bird dog that sits on the front porch of a 10-acre piece of land that are covered in deer and turkey and you name it, all the creatures of the southeast. And he just sits there with his little paws crossed, sitting on the front porch, looking off, smiling.
You know, I mean, I know Blue isn't going to speak English to you, but it seems like you and Blue both went through this together, and you're now in a place surrounded by people who didn't go through this. Does having Blue nearby, you know, help you, I don't know, have somebody there who understands?
He is. As a matter of fact, he sleeps in the bed with us. As a matter of fact, a lot of times he gets up between me and my wife, and he lays his head on her shoulders, and he puts his feet on my back. And he's always part of the life. He's always part of the story. Blue actually has a very intimate relationship with my family. And it started, believe it or not, on the day he was born, because Blue is called Blue because he was born stillbirth. He was the last dog of the last litter from Samson and Delilah, which were my stud and dam. And when he was born, my first wife, Brandy, was a nurse, and she said, I'm not going to lose a puppy. And she gave Blue mouth to snout and chest compressions and brought him back. So now when I have Blue with me, as hard as it is to think about it, but it is also joyful to think about it, he's alive because my first wife's breath was in his body. So the emotional tie to him, there's no words for it. And one day I know that he's going to go on, but he will have done his job as being the support that I needed at the time I needed it. And I know that God will choose the right time for Blue to go on to his next adventure as well.
Other people we've talked, we were in Oso last night and talked to some folks. They mentioned the community as tight-knit, as you did at the beginning of this interview, and they said it's become more so in the 5 years since. And I wonder if that holds true, even if you're somewhere else as you are.
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. Whenever, as a matter of fact, last summer I came out to Washington State. I brought my little travel trailer and we parked up there in the Mount Vernon area and then up in the Bo Edison area where one of my daughters live. And we stayed up there and we visited grandchildren and we came down to the valley and we went out to Darrington and visited friends that were out there. It's a family bond. And that was one of the things that was so sweet about living in Oso. It was one of those communities to where you could knock on the door and ask your neighbor, hey, do you have some children's Tylenol? My child is sick and it's a long drive into town. And everybody was always there to help each other out. I mean, when I first moved there, John Riggelbrugge, who was the Navy commander, would come over to my property and we'd both grab big weed whackers and we'd just sit there and work on the blackberries because we knew they were good to be out there, but they could take over 5 acres in a heartbeat. We would raise turkeys together and we would harvest them and we would take the turkeys around to all the neighbors so that they would have fresh, homegrown, organic-raised, traditional, non-processed gifts that were from our heart.
You know, it's interesting to me how sometimes the simple things become the things we remember, right? I mean, you just described, you know, essentially doing yard work. And it's things like that that are like really special to people, that that when you look back on your time in a place, those are the things that seem to stick with you, you know?
Exactly. And we had one of our neighbors, his name was Scott, and his wife was Debbie. Their last name was Rule. They had moved away before the slide, but Scott had passed away just shortly before the slide from cancer. But one of the best memories I have of Scott was he would come over to the edge of his white picket fence, and it would be right next to my garden, and he and Debbie would stand there, and he'd point down at the bush and he'd go, "I think I see a strawberry. I think it's ready." And we'd go down there and we'd pick up a handful of strawberries and hand it to him. And we'd sit there while we were harvesting the strawberries and talking and just sharing fellowship. We were building a bond. And it was one of those bonds that doesn't go away. And when he passed from the disease that he had, of course, his wife moved away. She is still with us. She lives down in the south of Seattle in the Kent Valley. But you're exactly correct. It's the small things that people do for each other on a daily basis, not the major things, not the gifts that you give at Christmas, not that any of those things are bad, but the things that are going to stick in your memory when you're laying there broken. And I still remember laying in the it's not a gurney, but it's the basket that they would put you in a helicopter. I remember laying there on top of the mound of dirt as they were waiting on a helicopter to come back for a second load. And one of the firemen, she took off her jacket and covered me. Because remember, I was getting ready to get in the shower when this accident happened. So I was there the same way I showed up on my birthday. And they were so compassionate, so caring. I will never forget those people. Asking simple questions like, "Mr. Ward, how many people were in your home?" And I told them, I said, "You know what? There were two, but there's only one now. She's with Christ." And they go, "How do you know?" Well, when you're married to someone for 37 years and they're no longer there, you feel it. But at the same time, I felt total compassion and total comfort. And what was funny was one of the other neighbors across the street, Miss Bobby's father, he was asked the same question. And he also responded, "It's just me. She's gone," because he could feel it. So there are bonds that are way beyond what we can comprehend as human beings. And it's the same bonds that we feel when things are gone. We'll never forget the best times that we had, the sitting on the back porch, the cutting of the grass, the weeding of the yard, just sitting out by a fire, talking and telling stories to each other. I'll never forget the bonfires that we had in the neighborhood. Seth Jeffers had come through. He worked at a log mill, and every now and then they'd get a piece of wood that just wasn't really worth anything. And he would trim two flat sides, and he'd drive to your house, and he'd take that flat side piece of wood out to your back porch. He'd cut two stumps off of it, and he made a park bench. But it was a park bench of love, because it was something that Seth thought enough about you to go through the hard labor of lifting a couple hundred pound piece of wood, putting it in his truck, driving it to your house, and with a chainsaw making a porch bench for you. So when you sat out by the fire at night, who did you think about? You thought about the man that cared enough to take care of your family.
You've described things that are very tragic and things that are very joyful and, you know, happy memories you have and traumatic things that you went through. And all of that is very complex. And I think complexity can be stressful for people, but you seem to really embrace it.
And I embrace it because I think it's what God has given me as a life lesson. But he's given it to me not to be quiet and not necessarily to be bold, because he doesn't want me to go out there and jump in people's faces and be too assertive. But I think he's made it to where he's wanting it to be a situation where when you find the pain, you can actually put your hand around that person and share the pain. Because that does help. When the Red Cross and the Lutheran Community Services people came out there with us, and they reached out and they said, you know what? Have a seat. We're going to put together some couches and a place just to sit, and we're going to find somebody that can help you to facilitate your discussions, not to run it, but just to be the facilitator, to be the person that can help to open that path of communication, open the right paths to the resources needed. And resources doesn't mean money. Resources means finding the right people that you can connect with, whether it be with some of the pastors that came out there or the priest or some of the community people that were out there, just to say, what is it you think you need? And some people would say simple as just a shoulder to cry on, and they would be there. Others, you know, we did need things to be taken care of. You know, when I left Harborview and I got ready to get stuck on the gurney to go to Warm Beach, I remember my charge nurse asking me, Tim, it's been a pleasure to be part of your story. Is there anything we can do for you? And all of a sudden I realized, can I keep the house coat? Because the surgical gown that I was in was the only clothing that I owned. And she smiled and she said, of course. And by that, my son-in-law, Ben Juarez, and my daughter, Brittany, had heard my answer. They got in their car and they head off to Walmart. And by the time I got to where I was going at Warm Beach, they had met me there with something as simple as sweatpants and T-shirts and socks, because all of a sudden they also realized, Dad's got to start over. They opened their home for me, and during the recovery, part of my recovery was living in their home. My other daughter, Tiffany, would bring my grandchildren by every day. The little things you don't think about, being able to hold your grandchild.
How old was she at that time?
Oh, they were 2 and 4. I had a grandson, Asher, and a granddaughter, Addison. And to sit back and to be able to play with my grandkids, or Ben Juarez's mother would come by. She had lost her husband about a year before, and she knew the emptiness. She knew the question marks. And she came to me one day and she says, hey, Tim, how about if I bring you some dinner from somewhere outside the hospital? What would you like? And she brought me nice cups of coffee and a little muffin or something. And we would just sit and talk about nothing necessarily that was that important. But it was just nice to have conversation from someone that was compassionate, that had been where you're at. So now I feel that, guess what? When people like this lady from Alabama that sat down and said what she did about the Lord, thank you, God, for all the things that she can see that were missing, because she knew she was standing on firm, solid ground. Well, now there's a place for me to be.
It's been 5 years. Does any of it feel different 5 years out?
The month of March will always be a hard month. The month of October will be hard for me, because that was the month of my wedding with Brandy back in 1977. November 1st was her birthday. So those type things will always touch a soft spot. I can be honest with you that this will never go away. And a lot of people say, well, it's been 5 years. Why are you still harping over it? It's not that people harp over it, and it's not that people focus on it because they want to. But from an unexpected change that took place in someone's life, you can't erase the life that was there before. And yet there's times when you reach for something and all of a sudden you realize, oh, I don't have that anymore. That's in a pile of dirt somewhere in Washington State. And I catch myself all the time. I'll be out working on a project, and I'll reach for a tool, and I'll know I have that tool. I know that specialty tool is on the third drawer of my red Craftsman toolbox. until I look at that Craftsman toolbox and realize that that's only 3 years old toolbox. And what I'm thinking of in my memory is from a past. So now, 5 years later, I don't cry as much as I used to, because I think I've come to more of a state of comfort because of where God has me on my day to day. But I don't think it will ever go away, and I don't want it to go away. You need pain of certain types to keep your edge sharp so that you can help other people get out of the debris field that they're going to be found in, no matter what it is in life. And if that's what it takes for me to stay focused, then I cherish it, and I want it to stay with me, because I want to be able to help those other people.
You know what I've been wondering, too, is because you live somewhere else, is there a relief in being surrounded by people who don't know about it and who aren't carrying it as well, or is it the opposite? Or
it's a double-edged sword. It really is. My first focus was I wanted to be there to be respectful, to be able to always go out there and have my quiet time. But at the same time, I started realizing that at least once or twice a month I was going out to the site where the parking area is, and I would sit there and I would pray and I would cry and I would sing and I would listen to songs and I would take care of the tree that was planted in her name. And I would look at all of those trees, and then I realized after a period of time that maybe this wasn't all that God had for me to do. And so I made the conscious decision that I needed to leave the area. But that's a double-edged sword, because that double-edged sword is one of those that you know you need to leave so you can grow, so you can do what it is you're called to do. But at the same time, you feel remorse because you're not in an area to where you can go out, to where you can sit, to where you can be in that moment of respect for those that were lost. And so it's a balancing act. It's hard. And I know that I've done the right thing. And I do know others that have left. And initially, I didn't understand that. But the longer I'm here in Florida, did I do the right thing? I know I did. Is it hard? Well, sure it is. I miss my friends. I miss being a fire commissioner out in Oso. That was a joy to be part of a community so deeply embedded in the day-to-day operation of little things that go on, the little finances, the little idiosyncrasies that you go through. But at the same time, you get to be part of the planning of the salmon bake and the Christmas festivals and the fire truck going up and down the dirt roads with Santa Claus on it. Those moments will never go away. And all I can do is pray that I'll be able to find those same joys, which I am finding already in the church I'm in the Redick area, that day by day everything is going to grow and it's going to blossom. That's the best way to put it. Our lives are going to blossom.
There's a memorial in the works, and I'm wondering if you plan to visit when it's finished.
Oh, I definitely do. As a matter of fact, there has been some woodwork that has been carved for me. Debbie was a chainsaw artist, and she created a couple different pieces of art for me. One is a life-size replica of my dog, Blue, sitting on a river stone, which sits at my front door at my house. And there's also a bench, which is engraved with the chainsaw on the front with the representation of the four dogs that were lost. And on the back is a big, beautiful red heart. And it says, in loving memory of Brandy Ward. Yet back in the Puget Sound area, there's a third piece of art that she has done for me, Debbie Tremenko. And that piece of artwork is a totem pole, which tells the story of our life on that Oso property. And when the memorial gets completed, that's going to be my contribution that will go to represent my family and the losses that we experienced and the life that we were able to joyously enjoy on that property out off the North Fork of the Stillaguamish.
Well, Mr. Ward, it has been an honor to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.